I'm very pleased to welcome back to the Catalpa podcast series, Margot O'Byrne. Welcome back, Margot.
Thank you, Michael. Great to be back.
This is one of the great, in some ways, untold stories for many people. Many people around Fremantle and deep in the Irish cultural traditions know all about it. But every time it's told, there are people who sit up and are amazed. So for those on the journey with us and have listened to chapter one in our first of the podcasts, we now come to New York and we start looking at preparing the escape plan in New York, as well as Boston and New Bedford. We've mentioned all of these places and their significance last time. And we've also mentioned John Devoy. And you've mentioned other individuals like Dennis Cashman, who was a Fenian incarcerated in Perth, as one of those brought on the Hougoumont. So what then happens? How does the escape plan hatch?
Okay, well, so the real catalyst for this, of course, is the letter from James Wilson, who's here in Fremantle Prison. And he was sworn in as a Fenian by his commander in the little Fenian cell that he was in, who, of course, was John Devoy. So when Wilson heard that John Devoy had been freed from the prison in England and had gone to America, he was moved to write a letter to him. And he said, remember us, remember the people that fought with you. You know, you're our commander and you're free. How come we're still left here in prison? He said, we are voices from the tomb. We feel like we're in a living tomb here. But he said, with your tongue and your pen and with your brain and your intellect and with your ability and your influence, we're sure that, you know, you'll be able to dream up something to get us out of here. So he was appealing to everything that Devoy had. Please, please save us. So
what sort of ages are these guys? You've mentioned how young John Boyle O'Reilly was, but what about Wilson writing from here?
Wilson would have been in his 30s by this stage, and Devoy also. So they were a bit older than, and you know, we have to remember that people did things a lot earlier in their life in those days. So your 30s, you're pretty much a mature man by that point in time. So Devoy was in that part of his life, and Devoy always saw that his mission, regardless of whether he was in Ireland, in a prison in England, or in New York, was to serve the cause of Irish freedom. That was the driving force of his life. He had trained, he'd been recruited into the Fenian movement and decided that he would go and get some military training, and he'd actually joined the French Foreign Legion when he was in his 20s, and he went off and spent a year in Algeria and then found that he was actually fighting for a colonial force against a native population and saw the irony in that. But at least he knew how to organise people. He knew how to command men, and he knew how to inspire men to do things. And so he was very much there. So when he arrived in New York, and at that time they formed an organization in New York called Clan na Gael, which was, you know, the clan of the Gaels, of the Irish. And the idea was that they saw themselves as the Irish revolutionary government in exile, that there wasn't any hope of another rising in Ireland for quite some time, so they needed to get organised there. But, of course, you know, in the new world, people find jobs, they find money, they find a different life. And so here was Devoy fighting the revolutionary cause, and a lot of others going, oh, that's a bit of a madcap scheme. We're never going to be able to, you know, release those people from Fremantle. What is it that you want to do? No, we should do other things. So it's the dilemma that all of us who've been on committees for many parts of our lives are faced with, is trying to dream up a plan and to then sell it to the committee. So de Vooy was a very persuasive man, and he managed to be able to do this. Like John Boyle O'Reilly and John Flood, he was also a journalist, so he had the power of the pen. And he would go round to Clan na Gael meetings all around the eastern part of America and tell them that, you know, they needed to work together and raise money because they needed to develop a plan to get these Fenians away from the Fremantle prison. And there were many, many people who knew about the idea, but at that stage, the plan was no more than they even at one stage thought that they might, you know, sail a ship and bust them out of prison in, you know, with arms or something like this, you know. So de Vooy decided that what in January and February of 1875, so exactly 150 years ago from now, he decided that he needed to go to Boston and visit John Boyle O'Reilly and talk to him about it, and Dennis Cashman and Keneally, who was one of the other Fenians who came from here, who was imprisoned in Fremantle, and also to start talking to various people about how this plan might come about. Now, as in all good organizations, you had about probably five, between 5 and 10 people who were the core group who were taking it on to raise the money and to actually build the plan. And of those, de Vooy was, they paid for de Vooy to go off and do this fact-finding mission, you might say. So de Vooy turns up in Boston, spends a couple of days with O'Reilly. They talk it through. Cashman comes up to the house for dinner. Keneally comes up, and then they say, the place you need to go to is New Bedford. And the person you need to talk to in New Bedford is Henry Hathaway.
The same Henry Hathaway that we were talking about in episode one, is it?
Correct. Yeah.
So he's
See,
gone from being first mate to being what a few years later?
he was now the head of the night police in New Bedford. So they seem to have had two sort of types of police. So there were the, I guess the day police were the normal police service that you might have, that we might have a similar thing today, upholding law and order. And the night police actually kept, you know, it's a port, a bit like Fremantle in the day, I suppose. And you know, keeping an eye on things, how things were going, whether stuff was being smuggled in or wasn't, that sort of thing. So that was Henry Hathaway's job. So it was quite a prominent person in the New Bedford community.
Now he was on the ship, the Gazelle, six years earlier. So he's gone back to New Bedford. Was he Irish? I mean, Hathaway sounds like a very Elizabethan English sort of name. Did he have?
Yes, he wasn't Irish at all. And remarkably, Michael, none of the American crew who are involved in this purchase of the Catalpa and finding the ship, none of them were Irish. So what it was, it again speaks for the power of O'Reilly and de Vooy. Don't forget, Hathaway had had months on board the Gazelle with O'Reilly in his ear, telling him about the importance of the Irish cause. So de Vooy said that when he met Hathaway, he didn't have to tell him anything about Fenianism because O'Reilly had definitely done that job.
He was a convert. And of
Yeah.
course, they are being paid for their troubles. If we had to raise the money, the clan had to get it all together. But just speaking about getting things together, how does Wilson get his letter out of Fremantle? You couldn't hit them
Ah,
on the
okay.
email at that point. And Fremantle and Perth was as remote from the rest of the world in those days as it is today.
Yes. But amazingly, again, we have to thank the Catholic priests. So Father Delaney, Father McCabe. By this stage, Father McCabe had been transferred back from Bunbury to Fremantle. And he was very much a person who was didn't see any qualms at all in smuggling out letters for the Fenians. Now, I've actually spoken to the Catholic archivist in Perth, and he tells me he went and did some research in Rome. And at the time, the authorities in Western Australia were writing to the Pope and saying that they felt that Father McCabe and Father Delaney were far too close to the Fenians and that the Pope should exert some influence over them. Which I don't know whether that was came about or not, but clearly they just went their own sweet way and were happy to smuggle out letters because, of course, these kinds of letters couldn't possibly have gone through the authorities at the prison. No.
So there we are. The letter's been effective. His old commander, Devoy, Wilson's old commander, Devoy, gets it. He acts on it. We're understanding, are we, that there weren't other colonies, if we can call them that, there weren't other prisons dotted around the world that were full of Fenians like Fremantle.
No. And Fremantle, these were the last of the Fenians in prison. So everyone who'd been imprisoned in Ireland or in England were all released. There weren't any anywhere else. So these were the last of the remaining Fenians.
It's outrageous, Margot.
It's well, exactly. Well, this is what they were able to convince people like Hathaway that, you know, that and now we'll meet Hathaway and Devoy seem to Devoy writes in his and Devoy again bless these people for the wealth of diaries and journals that they have left for us, Michael. You know, so we have their direct words. And he says, I spent every morning at Hathaway's house with him and every night in the courthouse. For days on end, talking through the plans, and
so,
it was.
So they're talking, but Hathaway's no sort of idle mercenary wanting to see the money. He's been here. He's been on the boat that picked up O'Reilly, quite apart from in a sense being a convert to the whole cause. He knows the terrain. He knows what has to happen. He has a sense of how unpopulated the land is. So does he come up with the ideas that Devoy then says sound good?
Pretty much, yes. And Devoy says later that it wouldn't have happened. I mean, there are several characters along the way in this story that it wouldn't have happened without this character at this moment in this time. And Henry Hathaway is definitely one of those. His knowledge of the coast of Western Australia, his knowledge of whaling ships and whaling industry, and his knowledge of what would be needed to do that, and his conversion to the Fenian cause, all were paramount in actually being able to convince Devoy that this was the way to go. So he basically said to him, you can't, because at that stage, Devoy was thinking, oh, well, perhaps they could sort of hire lease a yacht, or lease a boat and go and do this. Now, sounds a bit far-fetched, really, but and Hathaway said, no, the only way you can do it is to purchase a ship. You need to purchase a ship, and if we find a good shipping agent, and I know just the man, then we can make this whole exercise pay for itself.
Why does it pay for itself?
Because they will hunt whales and they will catch sperm whales, and sperm whale oil was a great commodity still. The electricity had started to come in, so the dependence on whale oil for lamps was waning. However, the ambergris and the oil of the sperm whale was still used very much in the cosmetics industry and in quite a number, and I think also in mechanization for bolts and nuts in industry, you know, which was rising up in America at the time. So it was a good commodity.
As we talk about it, a lot of things come out for those of us who are even a bit older than those who are younger, that people got around the world by ship in the period we're talking about. If you look at the shipping charts and you look at the small and larger port, ships were coming and going all the time. The the flow of traffic. You've mentioned Colombo, you've got South Africa, you've got New Zealand, you've got the Pacific, and whaling was a big thing in the town of Albany in Western Australia until relatively recent times. During my lifetime, whaling was conducted. It really was a big thing, and the American whalers were sort of a part of almost our cultural history, were they not?
Certainly, and certainly both in and also, sealers along the south coast of WA. So we had sealers on the south coast, we had whalers in Albany, and we had whalers in Bunbury. And Bunbury was a port where you could refurbish and reprovision and so on, So the whalers would leave New Bedford, they'd go to the Azores, to the Cape Verde, to Tenerife, or to Cape Town. So they were well, as you said, well known and well documented routes, and they all were, quite. There was so much information and so much sharing about this that we just really have no idea today, I don't think, just how important shipping was to communication, to industry, to trade, to everything.
And for the point of this story, if you were going to mount a rescue mission and pick up a swag of Athenians in remote Western Australia, one of the best covers you could have would be an American whaler.
That's right. That's right. Because, they've still been coming in here, and also because a lot of the North American coast, the North Atlantic, had actually been fished out of Wales by that stage, so they had to go further afield, and Western Australia and New Zealand, as you said, were good whaling grounds for the American whalers at that time.
Margot, this story just gets more interesting by the moment. In chapter three, we're going to get into the nitty-gritty of it, aren't we?
We are indeed. So let's just so here we have John Devoy here in with Henry Hathaway, and Henry Hathaway says to him, "I need to introduce you to the best shipping agent that there is in New Bedford." And this man is known as John T. Richardson, and he is a very savvy whaling agent. He has an outfitter's shop in New Bedford, so he will provision all the whaling ships that are going further south into the Atlantic and further into the Indian Ocean. He'll be able to do ships pro find all he's the mover and shaker who gets it all together and makes it all happen. And John Richardson is a Quaker, and I think this is important in this
Interesting,
story,
isn't it? Yes.
because he has a revulsion for injustice. He's not Irish, hasn't had anything to do with Ireland or anything like that, but his whole sense of injustice. So you can imagine by this stage, Hathaway and Devoy must have been quite worked up about their scheme and their cause and how important it is and so on. So they talk to John Richardson and say, "This is what we need to do. We need to purchase a whaling ship, and we want you to be the agent that'll find one for us." And Devoy said of Richardson, he said he was sympathized fully with us, and he was a st had that sturdy Yankee spirit that went into the enterprise fully aware of the risks involved.
Well, it really is interesting, and you think we lose the sense of what's going on in the world all those years ago. And I suppose if you don't have good records, as you said earlier, you have to reconstruct. But we don't have to do a lot of reconstructing here, Margot. We've got in 1867 a Fenian uprising. The Brits clamped down on them all. People are taken off and sent hither and thither. Those who were in the British Army were considered entirely traitorous, the military Fenians, and they were treated badly, never to see the light of day again, never to be pardoned. And then the last convict ship to Australia, the Hougoumont, brings these guys here. O'Reilly gets his leave of pass via the good graces of a Catholic priest in Bunbury, put on American whaling ship and finds his way to become a US patriot in Boston editing a newspaper. But these guys aren't forgotten about. And they're educated, they maintain their sense of grievance. And in case their old Irish Fenian friends might have forgotten about them, people like Wilson write to them and say, "We're still here, buddy. Do something about it."
That's right. That's
And
right.
you've got access to the correspondence. You could sort of be at the committee meeting, maybe.
And by gosh, do I understand that,
Well, we'll bring this chapter two podcast to an end, because in chapter three, what's going to happen?
Okay, well, we've got the idea now that we need a ship. Richardson can come up and Hathaway together can come up to Devoy and say, we can actually make this journey. We can, you've got the money to purchase. If you can raise the money to purchase the ship, we can tell you how, we can get a captain and a crew and actually make it work so that you return the money. And then when you come back, you can sell the ship and you can recoup the expenses that you will have spent on this trip. But what they need at this stage is a ship, a good ship, and Richardson goes about to try and find, they engage him to try and find that, and they need a good captain. And both Hathaway and Richardson look at each other and say, we've got just the man in mind.
Well, listeners, you are really on tenterhooks now, I know. But you will have to come back for chapter three of the Catalpa podcast. This gets even more exciting by the moment, Margot. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Michael. I really appreciate it.